Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the second part of a speech by Dr. Graham McQueen, given on September 13, 2009 in New York City, called The 9/11 Truth Movement Challenges the Peace Movement. It's about 10 minutes long, and it'll be followed by three audio clips from An Iraqi Vet Against the War, Canadian researcher Michelle Chusadovsky, and Glenn Ford, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Graham McQueen. Dr. Graham McQueen is a retired member of the Religious Studies Department at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, where he was associate professor. His academic specialization was Buddhist Studies, in which he received his doctorate from Harvard University. In 1989, Graham helped found McMaster's Center for Peace Studies, of which he became director from 1989 until 1996. He was also a founder and co-director of the center's War and Health Program Committee and was co-director of the three-year Health of Children in War Zones project funded by Health Canada. The project was active in three war zones. Graham has been active in organizations committed to peace and human rights for many years and has at various times chaired the Hamilton Disarmament Coalition, the Board of Directors of Peace Magazine, and the National Coordinating Committee of Peace Brigades International in Canada. He's also a committed teacher and has been awarded a teaching award for his undergraduate course, Theory and Practice of Nonviolence, as well as a Lifetime Achievement Award by the McMaster Student Union. He has currently, in the last few years, been active in the 9/11 Truth Movement. And here's the final part of his speech.
A digression here. In ancient Rome, when war was decided upon, a priest was sent into the temple of Mars, the war god. He would shake the sacred spears and say, Mars Vigila, meaning wake up, god of war, wake up. And off would go the Roman legions to devastate some place or other and add it to the empire. And it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that in August 1964, Lyndon Johnson came into Congress with his fraudulent Gulf of Tonkin incident and shook the sacred spears. He said, Mars Vigila. And Congress stood up almost to a person and said, yes, wake up, God of War. The vote was 414-0 in the House of Representatives, 88-2 in the Senate. And the God of War woke up, and by the time he was finished with Southeast Asia, millions of people were wounded and dead, and whole ecosystems had been destroyed. That's what war does, and that's what a fraudulent trigger incident does, and I should have known. Not only does this lead to death of the enemy, of course, war fraudulent trigger incidents lead to the restriction of civil rights at home. This is not a new insight. This is what war does. It doesn't just harm those attacked, it harms the host society. And I'm going to quote David Dodge here, who founded what is often said to be the oldest peace society in the modern peace movement in New York City, the New York Peace Society, which he founded in 1815. And he understood this principle. This is what he said. To inflame a mild republic with the spirit of war is putting all its liberties to the utmost hazard. I don't know what David Dodge would think of his mild republic today, which eats up half of the world's military expenditures. 190 states in the world, the United States spends half of the total military budget of the world. What happened to the mild republic? It was inflamed again and again and again and again, and the war system took hold and is very powerful, I'm afraid to say, in this society today. So, to get back to my rather fragile autobiographical thread, I should have been aware of my duty to study 9/11, to see if it was genuine, to teach my students about it. And I have done my best since then, especially in the last 2 years, to make the study of fraudulent trigger incidents and false flag operations part of the curriculum of peace studies at that university. Like most people in the peace movement, I understood enough after 9/11 to say the attacks of 9/11 do not justify invasions of countries. I was right to say this, and the peace movement was right to say this. But we missed the second thing we should have said, which is, when it comes to war, we don't trust governments. We don't trust the government's account of 9/11. We aren't satisfied with the chain of faith, and we're going to look into it ourselves. This has been a major failing of the peace movement, and this is one of the reasons the 9/11 truth movement was even perhaps just a dash rude. I don't suggest rudeness. I don't think it's usually very helpful. But he did challenge me, and he said, "This is important. You must look at it. There's good work on it. You're not doing your homework." And I said, okay, recommend a couple of things and I'll read them. Because you're right, I haven't done my homework. He recommended them, I read them, and of course I watched the official narrative dissolve before my eyes in 2 or 3 days. I want to offer that same challenge to the rest of the peace movement. This is important. How can you claim to understand war if you don't understand the events that trigger it? Barry and Ian stood up and gave us 55 examples of fraudulent events that lead to war and violence. You don't have to memorize the 55, but you got to understand the basics. And if you don't trust governments on war, then for heaven's sakes, look into this. Since 2005, then, I have taken it to be my task to be a civil society researcher and to participate in this amazing, probably historically unprecedented, civil society investigation, to which many people have contributed, including many of you in this room today. And I'm honored to be here with you, to be here with Richard, for example, who's contributed to this, and to all of you. We don't have time to go through the research I've done, but I do want to direct you to a place where you can find it. You just have to Google Journal of 9/11 Studies, open access, free, peer-reviewed journal, and you'll find the 4 articles that I've written since 2006, and I'll just tell you what they are. The first one is 118 witnesses. That's where I look at the testimony of over 100 members of the New York Fire Department that they perceived explosions at the time of the collapse of the Twin Towers. Second article is called Waiting for Seven, and it looks at the fact that dozens of firefighters knew that Building 7 was coming down long before it came down, sometimes over 4 hours before it came down. This is, of course, virtually impossible according to the official theory, where this was an unprecedented event, the first time in history that a tall building collapsed from fire alone. Third article is called The Missing Jolt, co-written with New Jersey engineer Tony Zambotti, in which we argue, in effect, that the fall of the North Tower, according to NIST, violates the laws of physics. Tony was here yesterday. I'm sorry he had to go home. I want to acknowledge him as one of the bravest and most insightful of your engineers on this issue of 9/11. Thank you, Tony, for all your work. And finally, the last article I wrote is, Did the Earth Shake Before the South Tower Hit the Ground? And there I argue there is strong evidence in the case of all three of the buildings that came down that the shaking of the Earth began several seconds before visible collapse, not after. I'm just suggesting that you read the articles carefully, make up your own mind. As far as I'm concerned, the general conclusion is that NIST and the 9/11 Commission are wrong again and again and again, and not just wrong, but deceptive on one crucial matter after another. Friends, and here I mean not just the peace movement, but everybody, this is the worst possible time in history to inflame societies with the spirit of war. This is the worst time to be taken in by fraudulent trigger incidents. It's the most important time to reject the war system, cooperate with the rest of humanity, to solve the grave ecological problems we face, which collectively threaten our civilization. As I draw this talk to a conclusion, I want to quote one of the members of the New York Fire Department, Kenneth Rogers, who was a witness on 9/11. We were standing there with about 5 companies, and we were just waiting for our assignment. And then there was an explosion in the South Tower. A lot of guys left at that point. I kept watching. Floor after floor after floor. One floor under another after another. And when it hit about the 5th floor, I figured it was a bomb because it looked like a synchronized, deliberate kind of thing. And I want to use his testimony as a kind of metaphor here. I want to say to the peace movement, the reason he saw things that others didn't is because he didn't leave the scene and he didn't turn his head away. He stood there and he looked at it. And that's all I'm asking the peace movement to do. Stop turning your head away. Don't flee the scene. Look at it, peace.
That concludes the speech by Dr. Graham McQueen called The 9/11 Truth Movement Challenges the Peace Movement. And now here's a short and moving speech by Mike Preisner of Iraq Vets Against the War. My apologies in advance for some of the background noise in this clip. It couldn't be edited out.
And I tried hard to be proud of my service, but all I could feel was shame. And racism could no longer mask the reality of the occupation. These were people. These were human beings. I've since been plagued by guilt anytime I see an elderly man, like the one who couldn't walk, who we rolled onto a stretcher and told the Iraqi police to take him away. I feel guilt anytime I see a mother with her children, like the one who cried hysterically and screamed that we are worse than Saddam as we forced her from her home. I feel guilt anytime I see a young girl, like the one I grabbed by the arm and dragged into the street. We were told we were fighting terrorists. The real terrorist was me, and the real terrorism is this occupation. Racism within the military has long been an important tool to justify the destruction and occupation of another country. It has long been used to justify the killing, subjugation, and torture of another people. Racism is a vital weapon employed by this government. It is more important weapon than a rifle, a tank, a bomber, or a battleship. It is more destructive than an artillery shell, or a bunker buster, or a Tomahawk missile. While all those weapons are created and owned by this government, they are harmless without people willing to use them. Those who send us to war do not have to pull a trigger or lob a mortar round. They do not have to fight the war, they merely have to sell the war. They need a public who is willing to send their soldiers into harm's way. They need soldiers who are willing to kill and be killed without question. They can spend millions on a single bomb, but that bomb only becomes a weapon when the ranks in the military are willing to follow orders to use it. They can send every last soldier anywhere on earth, but there will only be a war if soldiers are willing to fight. And the ruling class, the billionaires who profit from human suffering, care only about expanding their wealth, controlling the world economy. Understand that their power lies only in their ability to convince us that war, oppression, and exploitation is in our interest. They understand that their wealth is dependent on their ability to convince the working class to die to control the market of another country. And convincing us to kill and die is based on their ability to make us think that we are somehow superior. Soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen have nothing to gain from this occupation. The vast majority of people living in the U.S. have nothing to gain from this occupation. In fact, not only do we have nothing to gain, but we suffer more because of it. We lose limbs, endure trauma, and give our lives. Our families have to watch flag-draped coffins lowered into the earth. Millions in this country without health care, jobs, or access to education must watch this government squander over $450 million a day on this occupation. Poor and working people in this country are sent to kill poor and working people in another country to make the rich richer. And without racism, soldiers would realize that they have more in common with the Iraqi people than they do with the billionaires who send us to war. I threw families onto the street in Iraq, only to come home and find families thrown onto the street in this country, in this tragic and unnecessary foreclosure crisis. We need to wake up and realize that our real enemies are not in some distant land. They're not people whose names we don't know and cultures we don't understand. The enemy is people we know very well and people we can identify. The enemy is a system that wages war when it's profitable. The enemy is the CEOs who lay us off from our jobs when it's profitable. It's the insurance companies who deny us health care when it's profitable. It's the banks who take away our homes when it's profitable. Our enemy is not 5,000 miles away. They are right here at home. If we organize and fight with our sisters and brothers, we can stop this war, we can stop this government, and we can create a better world.
Well, if we're going to organize to stop the wars and our government that wages them, we'd better do it soon, because it looks like there could be yet another war on the horizon. The U.S. and Israel look like they're about to attack Iran. And here's Canadian researcher Michel Chusadovsky, director of the Center for Research on Globalization, which hosts the award-winning website globalresearch.ca, discussing the potential for a war with Iran. This speech was given in February 2010.
Well, this rhetoric directed against Iran has been ongoing for several years. In fact, it started in the immediate wake of the invasion of Iraq. And I think what is important to understand is that the United States, NATO, as well as Israel, are involved and have been involved in planning a war directed against Iran, and what they want is to essentially have the support of public opinion, present Iran as a threat to global security due to its alleged nuclear weapons, which it doesn't have, and of course present a justification and a pretext for humanitarian intervention on behalf of the international community. What I think people have to understand is, A, Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons, and B, there are a number of European countries which are considered to be non-nuclear states which have nuclear weapons, and I'm talking about Belgium, Holland, Germany, Italy, and Turkey. These are five non-nuclear states which have nuclear weapons made in America, stationed in their military bases, and these are, in fact, targeted at Iran. It's a clear case of distortion and double standards. It's the build a war pretext incident. And I think what is very serious here is that if any kind of military action directed against Iran will immediately lead to escalation. Namely, at the moment we have three distinct war theaters in the Middle East. We have Afghanistan and overflowing into Pakistan on the one hand. We have Iraq and Palestine. Now, the moment there is any kind of military action, punitive action directed against Iran, that whole region will flare up from the eastern Mediterranean right to the Chinese border. And we must also understand that this action against Iran is also indirectly targeting two main countries, China and Russia, which have extensive military cooperation agreements with Iran. And consequently, this has to be understood as part of a global war. If there is an attack on Iran, I think we must understand that we are potentially in a World War III scenario. That whole region flares up, and if other countries intervene, such as China or Russia, even in a passive way, we are in a World War III scenario. I know for a fact that this war has been prepared since late 2004 in terms of the stockpiling of weapons, establishing a state of readiness. All that is underway. Just about a year ago, the United States sent in a mission to Israel to modernize their air defense system. And the air defense system of Israel is now integrated into that of the United States and NATO. So that, in effect, what we're seeing is the coalescence of an alliance between the United States, NATO, and Israel. It's a formidable force in terms of capabilities. The issue is that U.S. military planners are often unaware of the broader consequences of their actions. They defined back in 2002, 2003, the notion that U.S. tactical nuclear weapons, what they call the mini-nukes, are harmless to the surrounding civilian population. In fact, the Senate then approved the use of these tactical nuclear weapons in a conventional war theater, and they said they could, in fact, be used on a preemptive basis against Iran and even against other countries. So that what the nuclear doctrine is telling us is that we can actually use these nuclear weapons as humanitarian bombs because civilians won't be affected. The only thing we're going to do is to go after the bunkers using, it's a bunker buster technology. And so that it's an extremely dangerous crossroads in which we are today. The United States has launched a military adventure at the global level with its NATO allies. And those who decide on these military actions believe their own propaganda. They actually believe that they're going to make the world safer by waging a nuclear attack on Iran. They may also believe that Iran is a threat. And so that the whole propaganda ploy, which is presented in the Western media, has got completely out of whack. It's a propaganda ploy which justifies actions which could be devastating. We have a situation where the major political figures like Obama or Hillary Clinton are in the diplomatic arena attempting to build this consensus. The constant and persistent reference to the war on terrorism as a justification for waging war in the Middle East, when in fact anybody who has some understanding of that region knows that what is at stake is the oil. 60% of the oil and gas lies in the region, which extends from the tip of Saudi Arabia up to the Caspian Sea Basin. It's a very strategic region. And why are they demonizing Muslims? It's very simple. They're demonizing Muslims because the oil happens to be in Muslim lands. I undertook the calculation that something of the order of between 65 and 70%, depending on the estimates of the world's oil reserves, lie in Muslim countries. So that is why they demonize the Muslims, present them as enemies of the Western world, and ultimately, if those lands had been inhabited by Buddhists, they would have demonized the Buddhists. So that we're in a situation where we have a war of conquest. It's the conquest of oil and gas reserves. The United States of America has less than 2% of the global oil and gas reserves. That region, strategic region, has something of the order of 60%. And Iran has approximately 10% of global oil reserves, five times those of the United States of America. And it's very clearly indicated in national security documents that the objective of these wars, ultimately, that's not something they'll say in public, but the objective is ultimately to gain strategic control over oil and gas reserves, and also to exclude any kind of competing powers in the region, which include China and Russia, which, of course, are countries which have important interests in the region. They're also involved in the oil industry in a very pervasive way. And the idea is not only to make sure that we control that region, but also that we exclude any kind of possibility that countries in that region could trade or have international cooperation agreements with countries like China or Russia.
You can hear that speech by Michelle Chusadovsky by going to the website www.globalresearch.ca. It's updated daily with articles about what's happening around the globe that you probably won't hear or see in the corporately controlled media. And again, that website is globalresearch.ca. The power elite were masterful in getting Obama into the White House and in marketing him as the anti-war candidate. Here's what anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan has to say to the anti-war movement about this in an article she wrote called Requiem for the Anti-War Movement. It's several pages long. I'm just going to read a few paragraphs. So here goes. 3 days after Obama swore to uphold and defend the Constitution, he drone-bombed a target in Pakistan, killing 36 civilians. And since that day, he has elevated the art of drone-bombing to new heights, while the so-called anti-war movement looks on in silent complacency, and while Democratic operatives disguised as anti-war groups are hoping against hope that Obama comes out strong with a new anti-war marketing campaign to assure his re-election, even though not one progressive issue has been propagated during his term. When the Democratic wing of the war party took over the mismanagement of the empire, the anti-war movement was effectively neutralized, even though the wars weren't. To read the full article or to listen to Cindy Sheehan's interviews, her website is cindysheehanssoapbox.com. And now here's Glenn Ford, the executive editor of the blackagendareport.com, speaking at the peace conference in Albany, New York on July 23, 2010.
Most of us in the Black is Back coalition are confident that the movement does not need some magic wand or killer application, mostly because such things don't exist. What we do need are organizations that are willing to confront power, willing to identify who the enemy is and to call them out, to make sense of emerging realities to as many people as we can reach, and to involve as many people as possible in forceful and sustained opposition to those who do harm to the people. A real movement breeds a culture of resistance, a widely held belief that it is right to resist, that it is virtuous to speak truth to power. That culture of resistance is what made Black America the most reliably progressive anti-war demographic in the United States. It was not that Black people were smarter than anybody else. We were just less confused. We had a better and a clearer idea of who the enemy was. That was yesterday. Today, our job is exponentially more difficult because Black people, who were not too long ago the collective rock of progressivism, are more confused about some things than most everybody else. In the real world, Blacks have been pushed to an even lower level of hell by the Great Recession, on top of the previous recession. It has been an unmitigated disaster in which Blacks have fared far worse than every other major group. But the Pew poll shows conclusively that Blacks are the most upbeat about the economy of all groups, and that a large proportion actually believe that they are better off than before the Great Recession. This is madness. And this madness, this great historical anomaly, can all be explained in one word. What's the word?
Obama.
Obama. It turns out that Obama is the killer application for the other side. He is their secret weapon. His very presence in the White House is a narcotic, a hallucinogen that causes all of the so-called traditional base of the Democratic Party to lose contact with some degree of reality. But it is most destructive in Black America. It was as this great crisis of the Black American polity was unfolding that the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations came into being. It was clear to the coalition that unless and until Obama's pass is revoked in the Black community, we could not be able to organize effectively. For Black is Back, breaking the Obama spell is the must-do task for a renewed movement for social justice and for peace. And there is nothing complicated about it. You simply tell the truth. Obama works for Wall Street and the militarists. That is the truth. If we play around with these essential truths, we defeat ourselves. The definition of defeat is a Black America that is asleep. Right now, there is a determined effort to use the Tea Party's white nationalist ravings to mobilize a circling of the Black wagons around Obama, thus diverting attention from the fact that Obama works for Wall Street and the militarists. Those same forces will try to morph the NAACP and organized labor's October 2nd march in Washington into a rah-rah rally for Obama and the Democrats. We at the Black is Back Coalition anticipate that this conference will endorse the October 2 march, and we agree, and we will participate unless that is made impossible. We believe that there are many NAACPs. In fact, NAACP activists have been part of the Black is Back Coalition from the very beginning. And we believe that we should encourage those chapters and those individuals that are serious about speaking truth to power. And the same thing goes for labor. But when we march, no matter who we march with, we must speak the truth. And Obama must get no pass, because that is to give a pass to war and to Wall Street. Thank you.
I'm active in both the anti-war movement and the 9/11 truth movement, and one of the big differences I see between the two groups is that the 9/11 truthers seem to have a deeper understanding of what's going on. For example, I don't know one 9/11 truther who believed that Obama was an anti-war candidate or who gave up their activism when he got elected, thinking he was going to save us. Whereas I know many, many people in the anti-war movement who believed he was our savior. Many still do, amazingly. So I was pleased at the peace conference last month in Albany to hear several leaders of the anti-war movement speak out against him. The tide could be turning. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.